location, but same class. There you go. So moving on in our topic. So we had spent all these weeks on the vessels of the Mishkan. And the next topic are the garments of the Kohanim, Big Day Kahuna. I don't want to go into these as in-depth as we did for the past few months when it comes to the vessels. We could, but I think we're ready to move on to something different.
Kohanim and Kahuna, some similarity.
Kohanim and Kahuna.
Didn't see the Big Kahuna.
Oh, the Big Kahuna. Big Day Kahuna, yeah, right. So I want to discuss this week, just in general, the concept of why the Kohanim have special garments. Maybe next week we'll do a few details, and we'll move on after that. I think we'll just spend 2 weeks on this topic, so we can move into something different. The Torah says in Parshas Tetzaveh, it's a mitzvah, it's quoted, as one of the 613 mitzvahs to make garments for the Kohanim. As it says, V'asisa b'dekosh Aaron achicha, you should make holy garments for Aaron, your brother, l'chavod u'lesifaris, for honor and for glory. The splendor. It applies both for the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, and also for the other Kohanim, the normal Kohanim. The difference is that the Kohen Gadol had 8 garments, which is, again, the picture is not necessarily accurate, but they're close enough to the picture. You have these 8, this is the Kohen Gadol, there are 8 garments, we'll list them in a second. And the regular Kohen, this one, which is where he had 4 garments to wear. So the 4 garments of the regular Kohen consisted of what's called the Nechnasayim, which is basically underpants, more or less. This is Nechnasayim. He wore a Mikbas, which is his hat, like a turban. He wore an Avnet, which is his belt. And he wore a Kasonis, which is like his robe. That's what the regular Kohen would wear. 4 garments. The Kohen Gadol would wear those 4 garments, except for instead of this hat, he'd wear that hat, different kind of hat. His hat was called a Mitznefes. The Kohen Gadol wore the Mikbas. In addition to those 4 garments, he had 4 additional garments. He wore the tzitz, which was the head plate over here. It says on it, Kodesh LaHashem, holy for Hashem. He wore the choshen, the breastplate, which had in it 12 different stones. Each one was carved with the name of the tribes. That was the 12 stones. And then that's in the choshen, the breastplate. He wore the me'il, which is this long blue robe that he's wearing. The meal had bells on the bottom, which would announce his coming and going. He'd be ringing.
He wore that robe over the other robe.
Yeah, right. And then he had this colorful thing called the ephod, which is kind of like a apron in a certain sense, but it was backwards. He wore it like this. That was the ephod. And you can see from the back, you can see the ephod from the back view.
Was that gold?
The ephod, no, the ephod was not gold. The ephod was made of stuff and colored threads. It was cloth. What was gold, I mean, there were some golden threads woven in to the ephod, I believe. The gold threads are woven into it, but it was a lot of other materials as well. So those are the four additional garments of the Kohen Gadol. So he had to wear 8 garments to do his service, and the regular Kohanim wore 4 garments. The exception to this is on Yom Kippur. When the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur went into the Holy of Holies, he would only wear the simple 4 garments of the regular Kohen. He would not wear what he would call his golden garments. That's the other 4 garments. And that was because, I mean, for a number of reasons, but the main reason was because you don't want to be presenting gold in the Holy of Holies when it reminds God of the golden calf. You're going in for atonement in Yom Kippur. To remind God of the worst sin in Jewish history is not a wise thing to do on Yom Kippur, on the day of Yom Kippur. So you wouldn't walk in wearing the gold to the Holy of Holies. Yes?
So you say they're called the golden garments, but they're not gold.
They're not all gold. I mean, they do contain gold. I mean, this is gold plated. This has gold strings in it. This is solid gold. The headpiece.
So is this the uniform he wore when he went to visit Alexander, who was coming to conquer the city?
I assume so. Yeah. This is his regular uniform for the Kohen Gadol. This he wore for anything when he was serving as the Kohen Gadol. He'd wear this uniform. So the mitzvah is to create these garments for the Kohanim. The Kohen Gadol with his 8, and the regular Kohanim with their 4. We're not going to go into details of each garment. Next week we might discuss a little bit about it, but I just wanted to discuss the general concept of wearing a uniform, why they have this uniform. The halachas of wearing this clothing are very serious, in that if the Kohen served and offered any sacrifice without wearing the proper clothing, the sacrifice is invalid, wouldn't be accepted by God, and he would be liable to a heavenly death penalty. So similar, we discussed last week how if Kohen served the lashing his hands, he also is liable to the heavenly death penalty. It's called Misa Bidei Shemayim. So too, if he served without his proper clothing on, he'd also be liable to a heavenly death penalty, which means that God would kill him in some way. It wasn't done by a court, it was done in the hands of heaven. But he would die prematurely based on this. So those are the main laws. So Kohen, you gotta be if you're Kohen, you gotta be very careful that you're putting on the right garments when you go to do your service. Now let's understand the concept behind it. I mean, understand the concept of uniforms, you know, work clothes, understand the concept of looking nice for occasions, but let's try to really understand the particular point being made here. The Sefer HaChinuch writes that a Kohen has to be totally focused on what he's doing. He has to be aware of his mission, he has to be aware of the impact and the importance of his task, and this, therefore, if he's wearing his priestly garments, he can look at any part of his body and be reminded of what he's supposed to be doing. So if he's wearing, even if he's wearing a nice suit, some everyday clothing, it's not going to remind him you are the Kohen. You're the Kohen Gadol. You're God's, you know, messenger to perform the service in the temple. But when he's wearing his special uniform, he remembers his task. And I'm very similar to a soldier who has to, when he's wearing his uniform, conducts himself in a certain way. I'm a soldier. I have a job. When he takes off his uniform, he might act differently. But a soldier in uniform is supposed to act in a certain way because the uniform that he's wearing reminds him of his conduct and how it's supposed to be. The Sefer HaChinuch compares it to tefillin, and I would add in even to tzitzis, which is something which we wear on our bodies. It's supposed to remind us of our task, remind us of our job as Jews. So when a Jew remembers that he's wearing tefillin or wearing tzitzis, that Jew should now be focused in on his mission. So that's how the Sefer HaChinuch describes the priestly garments. The Sephorno, one of the early commentators in the Chumash, he mentions another point. If you look at the verse we quoted, it said you should make these lechavod l'sifaris, for honor and for splendor. For honor and for splendor. So what's the idea of honor and splendor? So the Sephorno writes that kavod, the idea of honor, is to show honor to God. So we wear the sacred garments to show honor to God. He found us. Good. Wasn't so easy. Yeah, right, the first time. So the honor is the honor to Hashem, honor to God. You wear the sacred garments. And many explain that these garments were actually models of the royal garments at the time. The Ramban, Rabbi Lechai, many commentaries draw a parallel between the garments of the Kohen to the royal garments that were used at the time of the Torah, the times of the Temple. So kings would wear these types of things, these types of robes, these types of headdress, and therefore, just like kings would do it, so too the Kohen does it, to show the honor to God. And that's the idea, is wearing these royal garments to show honor to God. We understand how that works in general. You grab a chair. Everyone's welcome also with a water, a coffee, tea. Rabbi Kaiser said it's all available for us. Which is nice. It's a good perk. So we all understand if you go to a fancy affair, you dress up nicely. And you dress formal. And why are you dressing formal? Because you're showing the importance of the affair. So when the Kohen's dressing in these royal regal garments, he's showing the importance of his job. He's showing that I'm a Kohen, I'm here to honor God, to serve God, therefore I'm wearing my royal garments. The idea of the splendor involved, that's the idea of honor. It's the honor of God. The idea of splendor, the Sforno says, the Tiferes, is that a Kohen needs to project awe and reverence for his position. So not only is he showing honor to God by wearing his garments, but people there have to see the atmosphere of the Beis HaMikdash. They have to see, wow, look at the people around, look how they're dressed. They're dressed in a regal, royal way. They're dressed in an honorable way, in a very pure way. And that's going to project out to the world the importance and the atmosphere of the place itself. So the honor is the honor for God, and the splendor, the way the word Tiferes, we're translating as splendor, that is how the Kohen's clothes should project reverence for the place and reverence for the position. That's the idea. Rabbeinu Bechaya adds in that we should see the Kohen, we have to view the Kohen as a king. The Kohen is a royal person in our eyes. He is the emissary of God, he's doing God's work. So he has to wear clothing for the honor of the office. That's why he wears the clothing. So just like, you know, let's say a judge sits up in his robe. You know, in America, as time goes on, there's less and less formal wear in general, less and less uniform. So we understand, certain positions still wear the uniform. And a lot of times, why does a judge wear a robe? That's the honor of the position. He's supposed to invoke a certain feeling in a person who's standing there in court in front of a judge. I think you still have in certain parliaments around the world that people in charge wear certain clothing. I don't have it in America, but I don't know, maybe in England they have it, some places they have it where they wear special robes and special gear because for the honor of the position, of the job, you wear those garments. So the Kohen is going to wear garments. What?
Academic robes at college graduation.
Good, right, yeah. Right, it's for the honor of the position. That's what it is. You know,
the dean.
Good, the dean of his special, yeah, everything. Right, good. So so those are all different concepts. So we've mentioned three things. We mentioned the honor of the position. We mentioned the honor of God. And mentioned projecting out the reverence and the awe of the Beis HaMikdash. The Rambam adds in, which is very interesting, reality of life. You know, we all understand that judging someone by their looks, by their clothing, is the wrong thing. You know, we all feel that, we understand that, superficial. It's not the right thing to do. When you meet somebody, you know, look how they're dressed, look how they look. You want to judge a person based on who they are, not what they wear. But the Rambam says, you know, there's a reality of life that people evaluate others based on looks. It's a reality. It's a human reality. As much as we try to avoid it, you know, we all fall prey to this. It's not, you know, we all do it. And the Rambam says, because of that, the Torah recognizes this. The Torah recognizes people judge based on looks. So the Torah has to make sure that the Kohen dresses appropriately so people look at the Beis HaMikdash and at the Kohen in the proper respect. So, again, it's kind of a concession to a flaw in human psychology. It's a concession to who we are. But on the other hand, that's human reality. That's been the reality forever. We judge based on the superficial. And therefore, the Kohen has to project that. Which is also why it's very interesting. I'm glad you found us. It's wide open?
Yeah.
Well,
partially.
Yeah. It's pretty closed. It's unlocked. Right? Yeah, you can close it. Yeah, thank you. We don't want anything wandering in other than people. So the Torah understands that reality of human psyche. We judge by superficial looks, and therefore it says that the Kohen should dress appropriately so people judge him correctly. Which is why many explain, it's not so politically correct nowadays to say these types of things, but a Kohen who had a disability could not serve as a Kohen. The Torah lists different disabilities and says that these disabilities disqualify the Kohen from service. And based on our modern sensitivities, we don't feel good about that necessarily. But the way that's explained by the commentaries is that since people do judge by looks, and when you see somebody who looks strange, your first impression, you know, again, it might be wrong, but your first impression is this person looks strange. Therefore, that person is not the one to represent the Beis HaMikdash, being that we're trying to project outwards the most perfect and beautiful view of God's holy temple. So the point we're making is not the disability, the point we're making is the clothing. You know, the disability we can discuss a different time. But it's a reality of human psyche, and therefore we do look at the clothing as something of significance, even though deep down we want to look at the person and not at the clothing. So, yeah?
Don't you think the clothing that the person wears is the way he wants to be seen?
Yes, I want to talk about that. But the Kohen is required to wear this clothing, you know?
Yeah.
The Kohen may not want to wear them, but he has to wear them anyways.
Somebody who comes with his hair wild or his clothes disheveled.
Right.
It's fine. He didn't wear any distinctive clothing. He wore the same clothing as the Polish
like a peasant or something. Yeah.
So what?
He was a Kohen, but he wasn't serving Beis HaMikdash. He was a Kohen.
He didn't wear any clothing that would distinguish him from anyone else, and that was so amazing to consider in modern time.
Right.
There are rabbis wear, you know, black suits, white shirts, and they're distinctively different in their clothing than the rest of the people are. And I don't know why is that?
You give me a few minutes. I'm gonna, get to it. Okay. Yeah.
Depends on what community you're in.
That's also true. Yeah.
I saw suddenly two men from our synagogue in Netanya's. When there is Birkat Kohanim, they're standing out. And I really think they're nice, handsome men, and they have nothing that you can see from the outside. And then we found out that one has a problem in the leg, and the other one was wounded, or whatever, uh-huh. In the war. So they couldn't participate in Birkat Kohanim.
Right.
It bothered me.
Right, I understand
today.
That. That's still today.
Today.
Yeah. That disqualifies the Kohen.
I understand why when there's the Katakoni, those two are going out.
Right. That's not today's discussion. Maybe we'll get into it. I just don't want to get into that today. Yeah, it's a very good question. It does get to you, but
yeah.
God willing, we'll get to that one eventually as we get around to that mitzvah.
Because we walked in exactly at that
Yeah,
subject.
Right. So in summary, what we're up to right now is that the garments of the Kohanim seem to affect three different areas. They're there for the honor of the place and of the office. So you walk in, you see Kohanim dressed in their royal, pure, clean garments. That evokes an awe of this place and of the office of being a Kohen. It's for themselves to remind them of their positions and to focus them in on what they're supposed to be doing. And it's for others that other people should see them in a positive light. That's the idea. These are the three different ways that the clothing of the Kohanim affect the surroundings. So those are based on the sources, very early sources, rabbinic sources we have describing their clothing. Now I want to move off into the concept of clothing. What is the Jewish view of clothing in general? Because it's an interesting thing. The Torah mandates clothing in certain ways and tells the Kohanim what they should wear. There are laws of what to wear, what not to wear. Not so many, but there are some. We know the concepts of modesty. We know their concepts of not wearing shatnez, one linen together. The idea of tzitzis on a four-corner garment. There are definitely places where the Torah discusses clothing as a significant thing. So I want to discuss what is the Jewish perspective on clothing. It's very important. We all know that dress often dictates our mood or the atmosphere around. There's a reason. Some offices are formal, some are more casual. School uniforms. The philosophy of it is to make a certain atmosphere in a school. The uniform puts you in a certain mindset. You have an office that has, a casual Friday. So there's different moods usually on a casual Friday. Nowadays, things, I think, are mostly casual, more or less. My father worked for IBM for decades. Used to be IBM was very formal. Back when I was a kid, he used to wear a suit every day, wear his tie, pulled all the way up, Eventually, before he retired, he was going there just, in khakis and a plaid shirt. That's, because they changed their policies and they changed the mood.
So, Excuse me. Do you think that school uniforms, it's also this way no child feels as though they can't dress the way others do. This way everybody, no matter if you have money, you don't have money, everyone dresses the same.
Yeah, for sure. There are other advantages as well. That's definitely one of the points made. That everyone will be the same. There's not competition.
That's
so
right.
There's nicer clothing, more expensive clothing. You're not going to try to wear the latest styles. That's very true. That's also very true. But it definitely affects the mood. You wear clothes to a wedding, different clothes on Shabbos, they definitely evoke an atmosphere. And we act differently in different clothing. When you're wearing, jeans and a t-shirt, you feel different, you act different. When you're wearing a suit, you also feel different and act different. When you're wearing formal clothing, you feel different and act different. We know that our clothing affects how we feel about ourselves and how we act. It has effect on our moods, effect on our, it's not many times even on our self, on how we view ourselves, and our own personal self-confidence. Depending on what you're wearing, you feel more confident, you feel less confident. It's a very significant thing. It affects how others perceive us. Again, unfortunately, it should not be that way, but we know it is that way, that when you walk in dressed in a certain way, people look at you in one way. If you're dressed differently, they look at you differently. We know that's how it is, and hopefully as they get to know you, they don't judge you for your clothing. But at first, people judge us. That's how we do it. That's the first thing that meets the eye is the person's looks, the externals. That's what you see. So it's important, and the Torah teaches us. There's a source in the Gemara. The Gemara says that Rabbi Yochanan would refer to his clothing, not as clothing, call them my honorers, mechabdusa, those that mechabdim, those that honor me. That's what he called his clothing. Because the clothing provides the person a level of honor. Both the way that person looks at his or herself, or the way that people perceive that person. But the honor of the person, very often, is channeled through the clothing. That's the reality of it. Clothing gives us our self-confidence many times, and we have to make sure that the clothing that we wear projects what we like to project. This is what Stan was saying before. We know what we wear is going to project out a certain mood, a certain emotion, a certain attitude. And some people, they dress in ways purposely to project this attitude. You look at certain kids dressing in a certain way, and they're trying to show a rebellious way to dress. They're trying to show a formal way to dress. And there's different ways of dressing, and people show different things based on how they dress. And dress is something as a tool that can really keep us in control of our actions. The Torah teaches us about dressing with dignity, dressing modestly, dressing in a way which evokes respect, but not ostentatious, not too showy. Not necessarily up the way to styles, but in a respectful, clean, modest way. That's the Torah's view of dress. And because that keeps you in a certain mindset. For instance, let's just take a very big extreme. You look at the chassid. Chassid has this big furry strimal on, he's wearing his long black coat, looks very different. it's going to be very difficult for him to walk into McDonald's and buy a cheeseburger. Trust me. As much as maybe he doesn't really care about, you know, keeping the mitzvahs, maybe he's gone off a little bit. But for him to walk in that dress, he won't do it. He'll go change and he'll do it. But he's not going to do it, and hopefully not. But I'm saying if a person is at that point where he has that challenge, wearing that type of dress is going to keep the person in line. So for us, we're not putting on the big furry hats, but the point is that we have to make sure our dress evokes the mood we'd like to evoke, projects what we'd like to project, and makes us feel how we want to feel, makes us do what we want to do. That's how we have to look at it. The idea of modest dress is that point. Look at me not for my clothing or for my body, for my personality. Look at me for my character. Look at me for my wisdom or my kindness or my humor or my friendship, but don't look at me for my body or for my clothing. Modesty doesn't just mean not exposing your skin. Also, your clothing, which just stands out, everyone's staring at your shirt. Wow, look at that shirt. That's such a beautiful shirt. So they look at you for your shirt. They look at you for who you are. And that's part of the idea of modesty. It's not just exposing parts of the body. Plus, the men and women alike. You know, many people look at the ideas of sneeze and modesty as something for women. It's not true. It's for men as well. Men also need to dress modestly. Need to dress in a way which evokes what's supposed to be projected from a person, which is not the externals but the internals. That's the idea of modest dress. Focus on my ideas, focus on my depth, don't focus on my externals. That's a very important way to look at dress. Rav Hirsch, he's very often he'll take Hebrew words and show how the words that are, what's the word? I think entomologically connected, they have the same sounds, are actually related. So, I think I said the word right. So the word, Hebrew word for clothing is beged.
Entomology.
Yeah. Onomatopoeia is like a word that makes a sound.
Oh, yeah.
Repetition.
Yeah.
Like buzz.
Yeah.
Right.
A book. Yeah.
So
the etymology was princess.
So the word beged for clothing is related to the word pakad. Like beged pakad. You use the same sounds in your mouth to make those words. Pakad or pokad in Hebrew means to command, to give something its task, assign something its position. In the Israeli army, I think they call commander mefaked. Is that right? Mefaked. Mefaked is the commander in the army. He's mefaked. So beged and pakad are the same etymological roots. So first describes because your clothing kind of assigns you your mood, assigns you who you are. That's the idea of a uniform in general, but our clothing every day. What we put on assigns to us how we're going to view our day, how are we going to view ourselves today, how are we going to project to the world today. So the clothing actually is giving us our assignment and our task. We have to make sure we put on the clothing which assigns us the job we want to have. Put on the wrong clothing which is going to project the wrong thing. We're giving ourselves the wrong task for the day. We're going to be in the wrong mood. We're going to project the wrong thing. People will take us, will perceive us in the wrong way. And that's the importance of clothing. There's a much deeper approach to clothing. If you think about it, you go back to the very beginning of the Torah, the story of Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava. And one of the points of that story that really stick out are this idea, they originally were naked in the Garden of Eden. They sinned, and then they were ashamed they were naked and had to wear clothing. That's really the very first mention of clothing in the Torah is that story. And it's an amazing thing that one of the results of sin is the embarrassment, the shame of our bodies, and the impetus to wear clothing. And the Torah presented that way. The Torah says, before the sin, the Torah points out very clearly that, let's read it to you, make sure we get the words right. The Torah points out very clearly before the sin, but Yishneim Arugim, they were both naked, Ha'adam v'Ishto, the man and his wife, v'ispashashu, and were not ashamed. Then comes in the snake, the whole story happens, they eat from the tree. And after the story, the very first thing that happens after they eat from the tree is, let's just read the actual words. It says that the woman saw the tree, it looked good to eat, it was very pleasing, etc. She took the fruit, she ate it, gave it to her husband, he ate it. And their eyes were opened, and they noticed they were naked, and they made for themselves these fig leaf belts to cover themselves up. So the immediate effect of sin was a shame of their body, the sense they were naked, and covering themselves up. So the Torah seems to put clothing in a very high point in human existence, because that was the result of the original sin. The immediate result was the feeling of nakedness and the drive to put on clothing. So what's this idea? It's a very strange thing. And then God comes to comes to them and says, so he says they're hiding from God. God says, where are you? Adam tells him, well, I hid from you because I was naked. I was ashamed. I was naked. I hid from you. He says, who told you you were naked? How'd you figure that out? That's what God says to Adam. Because you weren't supposed to know that. You weren't supposed to feel ashamed of your nakedness. And only because you sinned do you feel that way. So the commentary has explained the following, a very deep point, is that deep down, you know, human beings know they're higher than animals. We know that, you know, you have a lot of animal rights activists out there, and the Torah puts animals in a way which we have to be respectful, we can't cause them pain, we have to only utilize them in certain ways. That's one discussion. But human beings, deep down, are aware that we're not animals. We're higher than animals. We have a higher calling. We have a soul. We have a higher level of wisdom. There's morality. There's ethics. Animals don't have any of this. And we understand that we're on a different level than animals. But our body, many times, displays our most animalistic side. Because the part, the human body, that's our meat. That's where we also are, you know, we're flesh and blood, just like an animal. And we have drives, we're very physical drives. And if we use our body like animals, we're ashamed because we have this sense that we're much higher than animals. Before the sin, it's a very interesting thing. Before the sin, the commentaries describe that they didn't see that Adam and Eve did not see themselves as animalistic at all. They viewed their reproductive organs like they viewed their hands, feet, or face. This is all just, these are parts of the body. They do their job. I'm not ashamed of my hands. You know, I'm happy to display my hands. It's not a problem. So the rest of the body was just like that. It was just like the nose, like the ears, you know, that there was no shame in the body because everything they did was for the sake of their higher calling. Everything they did was for the sake of God. They didn't have animalistic lusts and drives. They didn't have that. It wasn't part of their life. So therefore, they weren't ashamed of their bodies. Their body, it's like an animal's not ashamed of its body because an animal knows it's an animal and I don't need to cover my body.
There are still tribes who are like that.
Totally nude?
Yeah.
You mean Australia? Africa,
Australia.
No, they're
yeah, usually they have some sort of belt or something on, don't they?
Well, that's what they show you on TV. I don't know.
The breasts they have exposed, but I haven't seen any pictures where somebody.
No, they just read this and I say, oh wow.
Okay, you know that.
They can feel anything.
There could be exceptions, but that's the approach that. That the human being usually has. We feel our body has animalistic drives to it. We know that we have something higher than that. You know, the human has a concept of morality, a concept of spirituality, we have our souls. And things which on our body, which don't seem to always fit that, the billing of who we are, we're ashamed of it. And it's an innate sense. It's not something which, you know, we're taught necessarily, but people feel it. People feel that shame. So at that point, as soon as they sinned, they saw their body as their essence now. They saw that they do have animal drives. They saw that not everything they did is going to be for the sake of heaven anymore, because they changed. They brought sin within themselves. And their main drives now become for human pleasure. Main drives are physical. They have to develop and grow and become spiritual, but they're not innately spiritual. Humans, you know, we're very physical creatures. As we get older, we mature, so hopefully we develop a sense of morality, of ethics, of spirituality, and we understand that, but deep down when we begin, you know, humans become very physical, and we still have those drives and lust as part of us. So Adam and Eve at that point said, we have to cover our bodies, because now they looked at their body as something which is to be ashamed of. It's kind of dirty. It has something which has this negative view of it. It's like a dirty shirt. You know, it was embarrassing for them. Why am I carrying around and displaying something which shows my animalistic part of myself? I want to only show my human part of myself. That's how they viewed it at this point. So they weren't proud to display their bodies anymore. Initially, they could display their body because it wasn't in clash. It wasn't, and there was no tension between that and their mission in life. So it was like with their hands or their nose or their ears. It wasn't any problem. It's very interesting that the way the Torah refers to illicit sexual relationships, it calls it giwi arayos. It's exposing the nakedness, because what you're doing a relationship which is done with holiness, husband and wife in a proper way, that's considered a pinnacle of sanctity in Judaism. A relationship which is immoral, that is exposing the animalistic part of the person, because you're letting your lust get the best of you, rather than your mind. Your mind says this is wrong, but your lust says do it. So the Torah says you're exposing your nakedness, because what you're doing is you're showing your animalistic part of yourself. The relationship between husband and wife in the Torah is described as a deep connection. Adam knew his wife. There was a deep connection between the two of them. It's described in terms of holiness, of sanctity, of coming together. But when it comes to an illicit relationship, it's described as you're exposing something wrong. You're exposing your nakedness. That's how it's always described. Lusa galer, lusa, do not expose her nakedness. Because exposing nakedness refers to you're exposing the animalistic part of a human being. And that's what we don't want to do. So unfortunately, we do find, you know, especially I think in more recent generations, and even before, certain societies where walking around nude became more acceptable. But that's because they viewed themselves as a body and didn't feel the moral calling. And I think it was very common in ancient Greece and Rome, people would walk around in the nude. You know, the original Olympics were done in the nude.
We have something in San Francisco now.
Do they?
Well, there's a certain kind
San Francisco,
of, yeah,
right, of course.
Certain kind of race or something that they can do.
So that's a certain point where the what? Nudist communities. So at that point, people are kind of ignoring the higher calling and seeing their body as the be-all, end-all. My body is this. I'm happy it is. I'm all a body. I am a body. Therefore, I'll display it. We have to always move in the direction of viewing ourselves as a soul, not as a body. Who am I? I am a soul. I am a body because my soul needs a body to function, but really, I'm a soul. That's how we have to view it. If someone says, I'm a body, and that's what I am, so then, okay, so this is what you are, so you can show it. That's who you are, you're proud of it, so show it. And that's that approach. But if you see yourself, I'm a soul, I'm not a body, my body is my tool for my soul. My body sometimes gets my soul in trouble. I don't want to show that part of my body, because that part of my body shows the animalistic part of me. I'm not proud of that. So, you know, we're all human. You know, we have a human soul. We have moral sensitivities. We have a higher calling. And therefore, we feel ashamed to expose our animalistic part. Now, eventually, we're going to be moving to the point where, just like Adam and Eve before the sin, where you see your body not as something animalistic, but as a tool to serve your soul, and you move past those drives and those lusts. For a human being, that's a lifelong challenge, to move past the challenge of the body and move entirely to the life of the soul. It's a very big challenge. There's a few cases you find throughout the Gemara where you have people who are able to reunite with their bodies after death. An interesting thing. You have, like, for instance, there is, the famous one we have is Elijah, Eliyahu HaNavi. Elijah went up to, he never died, he went up to heaven alive, and at times he appears in his body in this world. At times he appears only in a soul, the rabbis teach us. Because somebody whose body has become so sacred, the soul and the body unite, they don't have any problem, even after death, where the soul is on its own, it's very happy to go back into its body, because it doesn't see its body as animalistic, it sees its body as holy. The Gemara says that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who was the author of the Mishnah, he was the greatest rabbi of his generation, one of the greatest of all time. He's the one who compiled the Mishnah. It says that after he died, he used to come back Friday nights and make kishya for his family after death. It seems to be with his body wearing clothing. That's what he would do. And it's explained that because his body had become so sacred and so holy, the soul is very happy to connect with it again, because the body does not represent anything animalistic. The body was a holy body. There's an idea that the Yaakov Avinu never died. Yaakov never died. And it's to be the same concept. The Yaakov became such a holy person that even though he's not in our world anymore, but his body and soul can still connect even after death. Means your soul and your body split. That's death. But Yaakov Avinu, who we say on a certain level didn't die, is because his soul and body did not need to split. Because his body became so holy, the soul could connect with it. It wasn't a problem. You know, our souls very often may be very excited to leave our bodies, because our bodies are involved in things that are very physical and do things sometimes the soul does not like. And it gets to leave and go up to God. It's very happy. But when the body is totally sanctified by our actions, so then the soul and the body can connect again. What's the problem? The body also becomes holy.
Why do we see that?
You don't see he reunited with his body, but you see that the Torah never records that he died. The Torah says, when it comes to each of the other people in Torah, it says Vayamos, that he died. It never says that Jacob died. It says Vayigva, says he became weak, Vayaseth Elamav, and was gathered to his nation. It never says the word Vayamos, that he died. It never says that in the Torah. So the Talmud says, because on some level he didn't die. On some level he's still with us. Again, that can be taken in many ways, but the Torah leaves out a word there and teaches a lesson. Right?
Wouldn't it be that, okay. I'm just thinking that he didn't die because we're all here.
Okay.
He was certainly the product of
the way. I mean, there's a lot of ways you could take that statement. But on one level, this is the idea of not dying, because the body and soul can stay connected. It's not, there's no problem. But there are many different levels of that statement. That's a big statement. Yeah.
Would you comment on the fact that some young children, probably to the age of 3.5, maybe 4, walk around in them and feel perfectly
like my 2-year-old. So
okay. Feel perfectly
I take off her diaper in public and just, yeah. You know. I think it's because when they're that young, they don't feel the higher part of themselves. It's like an animal. An animal doesn't mind walking around nude because it's an animal and it sees itself totally as an animal. I think a child, before they develop any sense of anything modesty. Higher than any modesty or ethics or morality or spiritual anything, so that or just sensitivity to society around them, so they just okay, I'm just like an animal, just like a dog runs around naked. A kid will do too. When the kid gets old enough, the kid understands that there's something bigger around me that I have to live up to. And then they start feeling ashamed. You know, it gets to be 4, 5, 6, 7, whatever age that is, they start feeling ashamed. Maybe 25, I don't know. At that point, they feel ashamed, and they cover themselves up, you know. But I think initially, a kid doesn't see themselves different than an animal would see. They're too young to understand, too immature to understand any higher calling, so they'll walk around like an animal.
Now, one thing I've heard, that Adam and Eve, there was sin all around them. Evil all around them, but when they ate the apple, they incorporated it inside.
Right, that's the and before. And then the many commentators describe before they ate from the tree, they were 100% good. There was no evil in them. There was no drive to do anything wrong. There were tests. The snake represents an external test. The snake came to them and tested them from the outside. After this sin, the challenges are within. We have challenges in ourselves. So we have to deal with our own selves telling ourselves to do the wrong thing, and we have to fight ourselves. They don't have to fight themselves. They only have to fight outside forces. Once they ate, then they incorporated themselves. That's the point. So we have to all view ourselves, that we are image of God, Tzelem Elohim. That's how God created us. To see ourselves as a soul, not as a body. And really, the human body should be a window into God. It says in the book of Iyov, of Job, it says, "Mibsari echse eloka, from my flesh I will see God." Because the human body is an image of God, so the human body should be a window into understanding God. That's what it should be. It's only because we take our bodies and use them for the wrong things, so our body becomes a blockage rather than a window. You know, the window gets blocked by something because we don't use it the right way. But using your body the right way, your body then becomes a projection and a window to understanding God, because the human body is an image of God. It's the form of God. So we have to view our bodies in that sense. So ultimately, because of who we are, our situation nowadays, after the sin, our bodies, you know, do have animalistic drives, and we keep parts of ourselves covered. But our ultimate view and our goal that we should have is that we want to slowly move towards viewing our body as merely a tool for the soul. The soul is who I am, my body serves my soul, and everything I do is going to be for the sake of God, like Adam and Eve prior to the sin. And at that point, they were never ashamed of their bodies. Now, for us, we're going to stay covered, but, you know,
yeah. Shopping.
Let's take covers.
But you know, there is also a very different attitude toward clothing covering up for women and men.
Right.
It's completely different. And it was like that, I think, from the time of the Bible, from the very, very beginning.
No, yes and no.
With ornaments, with the earrings, with the this and with that. You know, they didn't give. For the golden calf, their jewelry, and it means looking at the women, it's very, very different clothing than looking at men. You've never heard men getting ornaments or things like this like the Romans did,
right.
Or the Greeks.
Right.
On the contrary, yeah. There were sumptuary laws enacted from the Middle Ages on.
What kind of laws?
Sumptuary laws, and what? Prohibiting fancy dress.
Oh, Sharia law, the Muslims you're talking about.
I think in the Jewish communities too. I'll try to look it up in the Encyclopedia Judaica before next week.
Right. I mean, it's an interesting comment because the Torah does discuss very often jewelry. It does discuss women receiving jewelry. You don't have any concept of that for men receiving jewelry. That's for sure. But there's a balance. There's a balance between the Torah very often describes. We talked about it last week. We talked about last week the women bringing their mirrors into the Mishkan, donating their mirrors. And God said those mirrors are so dear to me because those mirrors allow the women to attract their husbands and create healthy marriages. So on the one hand, you know, women are encouraged to dress nice to attract their husband to create healthy marriages. Both attract the husband initially, and as they're married, that's encouraged. And that's to create the bond between husband and wife. That's something very encouraged and very appropriate. But the modesty in terms of relating to other people is also very important. And there's a balance that's struck. There's a balance that someone's going to dress nice and attractive, but not attract too much. You know, it's this balance that people have to strike, and we all have to feel what the proper balance is. Even Rabbi Akiva, as Gemara records, bought his wife. He was very poor initially, and he told his wife, "I love you so much. If I could buy you this really fancy, it was like a golden image of Jerusalem, and it was some sort of like I think headplate or something. I would wish I could buy it for you." Then later on in life, as he became wealthy, he actually bought her this really fancy piece of jewelry. And this is Rabbi Akiva, one of the holiest rabbis in the entire Talmud. He's buying this fancy jewelry for his wife because it made her feel her self-respect. It made her feel attractive to her husband. And therefore, that promoted a healthy marriage. That's how I understand it. But always to strike a balance. There's a limit. We have to make sure that we dress respectfully. We project the image we want to project. We want to be attractive to other people so that people want to be around us, so we can attract the spouse, so we can have a loving relationship with the spouse. But we never want to overdo it. Because when we overdo it, people are going to look at us for the externals, for what we wear, not for who we are. So, I mean, that balance is, there's no clear definition that everyone's going to strike that balance in their own way, but that balance has to be there. And the other part of the question is that the reason that we look at the laws of tznius more in relation to women than men, I mean, Torah prescribes tznius for men as well. Men also have to dress modestly. Men should not be walking around exposing themselves either. That's clear. That's
really clear. A black suit, a white shirt, and a black yoke.
Well, that's one extreme.
What is this thing that comes, the black?
Give me 1 second. I'll get to that.
Okay.
But 1 second. But the idea of modesty applies to everybody. That's for sure. The concept, the reason that when people are so focused on women, cover this, cover that, this long, this short, it's because the Torah knows good and well that the men look at externals more than women look at it. It's very clear. If you took the statistics of how many, I hate to say it, but how many rapists and abusers out there are men versus women, you're going to have a very disproportionate amount, because men have a certain lust women do not have, and men are attracted in ways women are not attracted. And therefore, we have to encourage, we ask women, please do not put men into compromised situations. That's one point. And it's true. Look at the statistics. I mean, it's very clear to this very day, the statistics. That's a human reality. It's a generality, but it's statistically, it's true. But it applies both ways. Men have to keep themselves covered and modest in the same way. Modest means covering skin, and also means not being too flashy or showy. The concept, why you see like this kind of dress out there, it's more of a modern innovation. It's, if you look at old pictures of yeshivas, even 100 years ago, they were not all dressed in black. I'll tell you that. You can pick up some biographies of yeshivas, and they show pictures from 100 years ago in Poland, in Lithuania, in Russia. Yeah, it was nice clothing. Usually it was a suit, but it might have been a white suit. It might have been a lighter colored suit. Maybe it had a blue shirt on. And the style of dress which you see nowadays that many rabbis wear, yeshiva students wear, I'm pretty sure is a pretty modern innovation. I think it was kind of to fight back against the tide of modern style and the flashy dress out there. You can't get more plain and dull than a white shirt and a black pair of pants. Yeah, so people need to keep it clean, keep it modest, and keep it simple. And that's where it came from. But that's by no means anywhere in halacha. It's not something which goes back. The Gemara does discuss that rabbis would wear a special coat. There's something called the chalukah derabbanan. The rabbis in the times of the Talmud wear a special coat. Nowadays you might see like a Rosh Yeshiva or a Hasidic Rebbe, they wear like an extra special long coat with special buttons, very fancy coat. And that does have sources back in the Talmud, because somebody of that high position, they should look dignified to a certain degree. They point out the Chofetz Chaim dressing simple. He was an extremely humble, modest person. He didn't have any official position even. He had a store. He wrote books. I mean, he was an extremely humble. He was an amazing person. But we were discussing the Kohen wears clothing to evoke the honor of his position. So too, you have a Rosh Yeshiva. A rabbi wearing a distinguished coat or a hat, a Hasidic Rebbe, because he has to show the honor for his position. We hope that he himself is a humble person, but the position is representing God, representing the Torah, so he has to evoke that honor and reverence.
It's like a cantor also.
Yeah, right. You don't see that too often anymore, but yeah, it's the same concept. You're trying to see it, really. Yeah.
And the big show.
Great show.
I have heard it said that the black is for modesty, the white is for purity.
Okay, I mean,
did you go along with that?
It fits. I don't know. That's, I don't think that's where it came from, but it definitely fits. I don't know. Yeah, it fits. I don't know. I don't know if it's any source for that, but I mean, it definitely fits the colors in terms of Jewish thought.
Sure, and you know, in whatever, the women dress all in black and white.
Yeah. Right, I mean, women dress that way in certain communities. It's funny. We went up to Lakewood.